I'll never forget the first moment when I walked into a cinema. I was hooked from there on.
All right, we are ready to go. We're about 11.
What's that?
Say it, don't be afraid to speak into the mic.
In some view.
In view.
I can adjust. For fuck's sake. I'm trying to provide good customer service.
Are you being done with the Queen in the second
group? You're trying
hard, man. Anyway, it's good and grim, but it's
you're
good.
You're too good at it, is my point. All right.
I just want everyone to get along.
So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about what we saw this week, the week in film news, and obviously top 10 and what's out this week. Mission Impossible isn't out this week, it's out next week, but you can talk about stuff and what you watched if you want.
Maybe I should wait till next week.
Okay.
They give me a chance to put my feelings in order.
Phil, you have a choice here. You could talk about First Reformed in what you watched, or do you want to leave it until new releases? Because these guys, when they were in Galway, didn't do a new releases section last week.
We made
new releases suits me.
We got waylaid by life.
Things I can talk about.
All right. That's what happens when you guys are sent down on your own. It's like
I shouldn't be allowed out without adult supervision. I think that's probably fair.
It's really a miracle you got any audio. Yeah. The oldest of us here.
I don't feel that way, although I do today. In general, no.
All right.
Oh, jeez, what a day. Anyway, sorry. Yeah, I'm ready.
Hello and welcome to the Scan On podcast, covering the week in film news, Irish and international. I'm Darren Mooney, and joining me are.
What do I say? My full name or what?
Go around! Okay, let's try that again.
I'm never usually on this side of the table, I just realized. I'm used to
this side is good over here. I like this side.
I can see things.
Sorry, this is, we've digressed. Sorry, Darren.
Let's start again. Guys take a week off and it becomes chaos. All right, so joining me are...
Ronan, hello.
And Jason.
Grace.
And Philip.
So we're going to cover what we normally do, which includes the top 10, what's coming out this week, and the week in film news. But let's start with what we normally do, which is what have you been watching this week? So what have you been watching since last we talked, Phil?
When did we talk last?
2017.
This is my first time I've done one of these in a while. So 7 months.
Everything. Let's work through 7 years, 7 months of Letterboxd.
But here, that's not a lot in my case. Okay, I'll mention that.
So it sort of jumps out.
All right, I mentioned a couple of things. Okay, so what? I'm close to the mic now. Are you happy? This is like a behind the scenes doc on the Scan On podcast. Yeah, there's a couple of things I wanted to mention that I watched lately. One of them was Loving, the Jeff Nichols film.
Oh, I've never seen that. It weirdly passed me by when it came out.
Yeah.
Who's that again? Joel Egerton, right?
Yeah. That's a film she got her Oscar nomination for. And well deserved. They're both marvellous. It's fine.
It looks worthy in the way that
it would be worthy if it wasn't so underplayed. It's not hysterical, it's not histrionic, it's it's fine. It's not overbearing like a lot of prestige pictures could be.
I think that this sounds like a Darren, it was grand kind of a film.
It was perfectly serviceable.
Have you seen
and maybe a cherry on top.
I like that on a bunch of critical cliches. Have you seen, was it the United Kingdom, which is a similar sort of thing with David and Rosamund Pike?
I haven't seen it. I heard that is also quite adequate.
Yeah, that's
Jesus, okay.
Solid.
Don't worry, Jay, it gets worse.
Okay, continue.
So I know this is a film that will have been talked about a lot here and in many, many other places, but I just feel I had to mention it because I was anticipating watching for a while. Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Oh, God. We had never talked about this before, actually.
No, and there are no strong feelings.
A few nice, quiet months there. It's been lovely. R.I.P.
I just wanted to mention it.
Well, Solo's dropped out of the top 10.
It was one I saw long after all when any controversies and debates about it came and went. It's pretty freaking atrocious.
You're on the right side of history.
No,
it isn't so much a side as the...
I'm on the side.
80% of the room.
I can only stress, this is only my opinion, but it's what I hate about it is that it's trying to say things and I couldn't care less because every character in it is so utterly horrible. Mm-hmm. Every single
That's
one.
That's pretty much it.
And just like, I'm not on board. I can spend time with horrible characters and make your own jokes about being in this room.
We missed you, Phil.
Yeah, me too. But it's just... Yeah, it's so full of hate for everybody that I just...
Not a lot to say about that either, which is a problem.
Yeah. Nowhere near as much as it thinks. Let me see, did I watch anything that could possibly lift the mood? No.
We can dream.
No, I'm just going through my list here. No, No. Well, I did rewatch Honor Majesty's Secret Service, which is still good fun.
Interesting film.
It's, yeah. It's,
I like the idea of it more than I like it.
Yeah, it's a, it's hard to take a film in which Bond has to investigate people who are suffering from allergies seriously.
A sinister plot to affect the world's livestock population is one of my personal favourite aspects.
Yeah, and it has some of the worst backshot action, you know, with the
projection.
That's horrendous.
And
Lazenby
is also not comfortable at all in the role.
It's not that he's comfortable, it's that he's... they're trying for something very different with this compared to Connery's Bond, and just... he doesn't... like, Connery made one more film as Bond after this, and he's like, he sticks out like a sore thumb. He's much more, dare I say, Roger Moore-esque.
I don't think he has the charisma.
I think he's got more charisma than people give him credit for, but no, not quite that much. He's not bad, he's just not the Bond that Connery was, or even in some...
The greatest Bond, Pierce Brosnan.
Here.
He's magnificent.
Pierce Brosnan is massively underrated.
Yeah, he's a terrific... I'm not a massive Bond fan.
Dalton's
films are quite grim as well, which
that's what I like.
Also the Miami Vice Bond. It's the only Bond that does like a Miami Vice homage, which I appreciate on some level.
Yeah.
It's good fun. And Diana Rigg, best Bond
girl. Yeah.
And Louis Armstrong, We Have All Time World, best Bond tune.
And... I have a soft spot for Telly Savalas as Blofeld. It's obviously never...
as well. He's a very serviceable Donald Pleasant replacement.
Yeah, well, he's never going to compete with Pleasant, but because it's like this weird, like, New York hoodlum who just happens to be working at a health clinic in the middle of the Alps for some reason.
As one does.
Yeah, it's so incongruous it kind of works.
We all have that friend.
We all know a tech bro. It's not that far removed.
Actually,
Elon Musk of 70s.
Alright,
so that's me. I tried.
Well done, you.
Yeah. So, Grace, what have you watched this week, or since last we spoke?
Since last we spoke, yes, I had a week off, so I was home with the folks. I feel like I should move this mic closer to me, because you can never hear me. Anyway, so I downloaded a bunch of films off Netflix, and then I went and watched a bunch of movies I'd already seen instead. I decided I'd revisit some of the films of my youth, so I watched Miss Congeniality. Which is wonderful.
Amazing.
It consistently amazes me how subversive that film is, because some parts of it, and one scene in particular, have dated really badly, but then the rest of it is so ahead of its time. It really is. And I always like the little commentary it has on beauty pageants about... there's a scene, if you haven't seen it, where literally an entire warehouse, like airport hangar of people push Sandra Bullock's character together for this pageant, like they do her... hair and her nails and all the waxing and blah blah blah, and I just always like that as a little nod to the amount of effort that goes into making so-called beautiful people look beautiful. Like it's not like they rolled out of bed that way. They did not wake up like this.
Bullock's probably my favorite film star. Like anything she's in, I'll pretty much watch. She's great.
She's very self-aware of herself as a star, and underlines that quite wonderfully and repeatedly.
Yeah,
not just in the movie.
She's great. She carries pretty much everything I've seen.
She has a fantastic character in Miss Congeniality, though.
I've never seen the follow-up.
The film is very affectionate towards her, I think, which is key, because it'd be very easy to just take this.
Yeah,
I think someone like her, it has to be her. There are so many other people you could cast in that film, and it wouldn't work.
Yeah,
well.
It's hard to imagine anyone else. So, I watched that, and then I watched Bring It On, which is equally fabulous and underrated. Bring It On, to me, is, again, slightly ahead of its times in terms of its approach to politics, because you have a whole storyline about a cheerleading squad from a very rich, privileged San Diego school nicking cheers, like choreography, from an inner-city LA school in Compton and getting all the credit for it. And honestly, this is a much bigger deal probably now it would be than it was at the time. But if you look back on it, I think it actually explores it beautifully, because you have a lead character who is immediately horrified by all of this and goes out of her way to try and rectify it, and is met with nothing but resistance from the captain of the Compton school, who's just kind of like, why are you doing this? You're just doing this to make yourself feel better. This has nothing to do with us. If you look at it through the lens maybe of some of the political discussions and social discussions we do have today, it would hold up pretty well, I think. And it's also just fabulous, very quotable, very fun. And then I also watched Coyote Ugly, which is probably iconic for all the wrong reasons. And I also, for some reason, the DVD version we have is the extended cut, which includes not multiple, I suppose, but scenes where you can see where they've been deleted, including one really, like, outrageously terribly shot sex scene, which is just wrong in every way.
Sex scenes are tough to get right.
Like, see Munich. Honestly, it's baffling how bad this shot is, and it's so out of place with the rest of the movie, and you're just like, why did you put this back in? This is brutal.
Curiosity's a killer.
I'm never a big fan of director's cuts for that reason. Like, I mean, things come out of movies because they come out of movies. Like, and I'm kind—they rarely get approved by
some of them. I mean, on the other hand, like Brazil. Yeah.
Yeah.
On the other hand,
yeah. No, if there is studio interference for a malicious reason, I can see it. But generally speaking, I don't really see the issue with directors revisiting films that they were happy enough to release at a certain point. That just seems absurd to me.
I don't know. I think that we live in the age where there's a diverse array. There's more options for media consumption than ever.
Yeah, but extras. I don't mind them as deleted scenes. Like, I don't mind seeing them. But
no,
I don't think it should be in the film.
Restructuring the film. I think it's perfectly valid for, like, to treat a film in some ways as a work in progress rather than as an actual. Because
sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah. I mean, like, I like that there are two very different versions of Alien that run, like, within a minute of each other, while the theatrical version will always be the better and classic one. I like seeing the director's version.
There's a minute in the gap.
He just changes.
Who the fuck cares about a minute? Like, I mean, I'm sorry.
A minute is a
long
time.
He edits it. It's actually literally a director's.
But this is Ridley Scott, though. He pretty much does all the stuff, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So, like, you know my feelings on Ridley Scott, so, you know. Let's not revisit
that.
We're early in the podcast.
As a final note on Coyote Ugly, I would like to point out that it really should be considered something of a gay classic, because I don't understand how, as a 13-year-old, I didn't notice that Coyote Ugly, the bar, is clearly meant to be a lesbian bar, and somebody in the studio just wouldn't let it be. Just wouldn't.
Yeah.
But anyway, moving on. In terms of films I hadn't seen before, I watched the documentary Losing Sight of Shore, which is about the Coxless crew who rowed from San Francisco to Australia. Took them 9 months.
Good lord.
No assistance, like, literally rowed. There's no, like, engine or anything in the boat. No, like, help boat alongside them in case it got into difficulty. It's literally just four women on a very small boat in the middle of the Pacific.
Jeez.
How does insurance work in that situation?
Immediately into the practicalities.
Yeah.
But it's, like, it's really interesting. It's not, like, you know, particularly philosophical. It doesn't really go deep into any reasons why they do it, other than to say it's for a charity. But the ocean photography is really beautiful, and just as an exploration, I suppose, of, like, courage and athleticism and endurance and everything else, it's really, really good.
Like that. Resilience, pure resilience.
Yeah. I think also my inherent misanthropy might help in that I'm like, 9 months at sea with no one around? That sounds amazing.
Well, you're with three other people, I imagine.
You better like them. Yeah. You better like them.
We have a whole crew here. There's four of us. There's five of us, actually. We have an extra rower. But, yeah. I also watched Caliber, which is the Netflix one, yes, which is curiously like a Scottish version of Eden Lake, but not very good. Eden Lake really scared, like, made me feel very, very uncomfortable repeatedly, and Caliber did not.
I was shocked at the kind of the big reviews were, like, it's got
a lot of love,
and I was kind of like gorgeous. I like that kind of film.
Mm-hmm. You just don't think this was that caliber of engine?
No.
Oh,
also, it actually nicks its central kind of plot point from In Bruges. But anyway, that's a different.
It actually does. Yeah.
But
the way that plot point happens, though, it's just so abrupt.
Yeah.
And even though you're like, this should be shocking, but it kind of isn't.
You kind of fumble it. Yeah, I agree with you. I'm going to agree with you. It seems like a kind of film of two or three different ideas unsuccessfully matched together.
Yeah. There's some kind of, I don't know, weight missing from it, even though you can't really... I think the performances are quite good. Direction's okay, but something wasn't welding it together as well as it should.
And there's some ideas in there that are interesting about kind of money coming into kind of dying towns and stuff like that could be potentially developed and really interesting that aren't really... They don't really go anywhere.
Yeah, and that kind of local vigilante justice type thing, which was also an interesting sub-plot point in the first season of Sons of Anarchy. Hasn't been done as well elsewhere since. that was kind of a missed opportunity. And then last night I saw Mission Impossible Fallout, which I loved, but we will talk about more when it's actually out next week.
Which is next week.
So that's me.
So Jay, what have you watched since last we spoke? Aside from the entire film flop.
Yeah, we'll skip the film flop. I watched a few before and a couple after, so we can kind of go. The first one I mentioned, which is by far probably the best film I've seen in the last while, which is Agnes Varda's Vagabond. Which I kind of This is my stopping point on Varda for the moment, because I'm hoping, against hope, that the IFI will have a season to go with the Faces Places release in September. And a few places are doing the season in the UK and stuff. So
if you're listening to this podcast, feel free to at the
IFI. Oh, I've added them already, don't worry.
Yeah, me too. Just send them every
I'll have watched those Faces Places and this one, and both of them are really, really good. Vagabond is astounding. And it tells a story about a young girl who was found in, I think it's a kind of winery kind of feel, anyway, it's just kind of in the French countryside. She's found frozen to death at the start of the movie, and basically it goes back over the last few days leading up to the point where she dies. So it takes a really, really, I think, intelligent and confident filmmaker to set up something like that and not feel like you're robbed of an ending all the way through. Like, you know, because there's no surprise at the end of it in the context of it, but what you'd want to be doing in that, you want to be doing something good, like, you know, and this does extraordinary things. It's just kind of, it has this kind of momentum that's like a march towards death, inevitability. It's Twin Peaks does it as well. It has that kind of, if you ever see Far Walk With Me, has that kind
of,
you can feel the pull though. Yeah. That's the talent. There's a similar thing. And Sandrine Bonner, I think, is the actress in that. She's incredible. And it's this kind of fringe town. She's kind of hitchhiking in winter through these towns trying to pick up work, and like nobody else is doing it because the summer season has passed, so she's kind of doing it, and she's kind of taken advantage of and by, you know, groups of lads and stuff like that, and kind of, but she's kind of also, she gets taken in by this kind of hippie couple who kind of try to help her, and she just fuck off, she sits around and doesn't work for them and tries to take their money and steal stuff. And so she's just one of those people who just wants to check out of society but and still make a little bit of money but not really doing much for it. So that adds that kind of a just march on, you know, towards that kind of end, and it just does wonderful things with symmetry, like in terms of shots at start, shots at the end, and then, but also has this mysterious and weird rough edge that kind of, it's just how Varda frames shots is really good, how she kind of gets close ups to the actress's face, kind of around fires and stuff. It's just everything about it has this kind of just inevitable stark beauty to it, and then you get to the starting point at the end, and it just works out perfectly in terms of the story, not perfectly in terms of the character, but it's incredible. It's an absolutely incredible film.
This is the best film you've seen this year, you're saying, or one
it's right up there. It blew me away. Like,
I've never seen Vagabond, but I've always wanted to. Have you ever seen Cleo de Saint-Cassette?
No, it's on my list of films to see.
It's just from what you're describing there, it sounds like they're going to be up a piece, and Cleo de Saint-Cassette is my favourite French New Wave film.
Oh, really?
When you're talking about the use of framing and how it uses faces, you're making me hope that the IFI do come to.
I think
you
will. I think they kind of winked in a kind of Twitter response kind of thing. So they generally say no if they're not.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're not happy to be disappointed. So they generally follow from the BFI as well. The BFI have done it. So
they're doing their bang up job on the old social media front. Daniel, you tease.
Yeah, so that obviously our new one has been released instead of Face Place, which is great. Yeah. I'm going to go to everything because there's so much, and I've kind of paused me watching. I'm not watching anymore. I want to see them all in the cinema now because they're just too bloody good.
Mm-hmm. I always want to see Cleo on a big screen.
Yeah, I'm there.
Yeah, it's one of those ones that I have not seen over the years because I'm waiting for that kind of experience.
I think that's fair enough. Yeah. Hopefully we'll get it.
Okay.
Anything else, Jeff?
Yeah, it's a Turkish horror film called Baskin.
Oh.
That's a
BB's the prequel. That's an old school reference. Yeah. Ask your parents.
It's a kind of a. I've been told a few people.
Ronan is looking very confused here.
It's
not unusual.
It's about a group of policemen in this kind of small town in Turkey who kind of respond to a call in this kind of like an abandoned kind of school type. It's hard. It doesn't really say exactly where it is, but it has a kind of asylum, blah, 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 kind of thing.
Yeah.
Near a kind of what looks like it's going to be some sort of folk horror kind of thing ground beside it, you know. And basically it's just this intense, literally stairwell to hell, because you literally go down into the bowl. That is, like, you make it very clear that that's where you're going here. Like, they're descending into hell in a very real sense. And it's really well staged. It's extremely violent and bloody, which, in the right way that this deserves. I mean, if you're going to do that, you really want to bring it on, like, and it does. And it's pretty effective. It's not particularly scary in a way it is. It's more kind of visceral thriller kind of thing, which it worked, and that's fine, it works really well in that regard. And it's a really nice moment at the end that kind of throws the whole thing off a little bit.
Somewhat
predictably, in the sense that about a minute before, I had a feeling that I was going to do this, and it did do it.
Only a minute.
I'm really terrible at predicting things. I'm really awful. I'd never see the endings coming to anything. I'm like, huh? It's like, really? How'd you miss that?
I'm sat beside you in cinemas. It's not, you're not quite that bad. I think if it got you within a minute, I think it's a good. The film did quite well. Yeah.
It did. But once it gets to a certain point, you go, oh, I wonder if they're going to. Oh, they did. Ah, okay. And then you start thinking about it again, and has this going to. I won't say anything beyond that. I don't want to give it away. Think about it. But it's worth seeing. It's not brilliant, but it's really interesting. Like, very well made. And I'll mention one more. I think, which is Resolution, which is. I think Donica mentioned a couple weeks ago, the Benson and Moorhead. It's the film.
Are these guys who did The Endless?
Yes. It's like a prequel to that. It was made a few years before, and in between they did Spring, which is pretty good. Like.
Oh, yeah, this is the one that turns out that Endless is a sequel to.
So Resolution is the kind of the first one. It's just kind of lo-fi kind of deconstruction of horror. It's very aware of itself, it's very smart. The script is really kind of dense, quite profane as well, which is kind of funny. But it's surprisingly light considering the amount of information it kind of has to impart. It's quite light on its feet in that regard. I liked it. It's well done. It kind of reminded me a little bit of Shane Carruth's film at first. What was it? Primer. Except it's not as good as that.
Okay. I still have a headache from Primer.
Primer's incredible. I think I lasted 30 minutes of Primer before my brain collapsed and stuff. I just let it wash over me. It's really tough.
Yeah.
But this is kind of aiming towards something similar, and it doesn't quite get there. It's not as good as that. But I'm not sure if the whole thing adds up to much in total anyway. But it's still a surprisingly enjoyable kind of journey all the same. So I'll get to the end of it at some point, I suspect. But it's not bad. I'll leave it at that.
And Ronan, what have you watched since the last we talked?
I have not watched a huge amount because I've been in flat recovery mode. We talked a lot about. I am flat out. We talked a lot last week about all the many, many, many films I saw there. But we mostly focused on the short housing of Sox and the New Irish Shorts. But I never got to mention one of the best features I saw there, which was Wild Nights with Emily, an adaptation of the life of Emily Dickinson. That's like this really radical reclamation of her legacy. She's often seen as this quite. Reclusive figure who was shut away for years and years, apparently. Yeah. Nobody other than her family saw her for 15 years. And what Wild Nights with Emily does is, using evidence that suggests that her original editors erased the names of the people to whom she wrote in her letters, suggests that actually she was a perfectly vibrant personality who was carrying on a secret affair with her brother's wife. There's evidence that suggests this.
All of a sudden, the entire podcast is
whoa.
It's like, whoa.
It's unclear if this was the case. It's fairly clear from her letters, which have been sort of analyzed with infrared technology, that she did have deep feelings for this woman, Susan. Whether or not they consecrated that, as the film heavily suggests, is unclear. But the film has an amazing time imagining what would have happened.
Is it jumping off?
And it is. I have to say, I had so much fun with it. It was the best feature I saw at the flat by a very, very long distance.
Wow.
It's hilariously funny. The cinema was in hoots the whole time. And, you know, me chief among them, I lost the run myself many, many times. It's showing soon at the Gays LGBT Film Festival here in Dublin over the August bank holiday.
Yeah, I think I'll catch it there.
I really, really strongly recommend it to everyone. It's hilarious. And I think it's only done festival circuit at the moment, but it's likely to get released at the end of the year. Molly Shannon is tremendous as Dickinson.
Oh, it's Molly Shannon.
There are so many amazing scenes. It's really concerned with taking down the great man mythos, and it has the likes of Ralph Waldo Emerson appear in the film, and there are just these constant brilliant asides where the camera will cut to Emily Dickinson's face as people talk about these great men around her, and her reactions are priceless.
There's
going to
be so many gifts from that for Twitter.
Yeah, so absolutely. I absolutely adored it. But to get to the point, one of the very few things I've watched since coming back from the fly, I was laid up on the couch just desperately trying to recover, was Terrence Davies' A Quiet Passion, which I hadn't seen. Because anyone I talk to about this film, and I've been talking to anyone who listened about it, has said, did you see A Quiet Passion? And I never did, so I went back and watched it, and it's really fascinating. I wish I'd seen it first, because
here's a lesson, folks. A Quiet Passion is on
Netflix. And I highly, highly recommend it. Davies is an extraordinary filmmaker, and it's beautifully done. There are two scenes that I went back and watched them again. They're, you know, it's that quality of filmmaking.
Yeah, it's great.
Not to mention it's quite funny itself. I laughed a lot. I really liked it. Don't, you know, let me start by saying that. But there's something about Wild Nights with Emily which is, as I say, so radical in... It specifically takes issue with the idea of the way we talk about famous women.
Yeah.
That A Quiet Passion is almost exactly what it's railing against.
Yeah.
And that really informed how I looked at A Quiet Passion. That's not A Quiet Passion's fault. But they're a really fascinating duo. Mm. And, you know, it's something I've been chewing over a lot since. Neither of them, I think, takes any enormous liberties. They're both very grounded in fact, and they're... Neither is, you know, a fantastical rendition of this life.
Hmm.
But they're very different, and in some ways they don't fit together. And that's really, really fascinating.
I think it just goes to show that we don't necessarily... We never found out the whole story about...
Absolutely, and yeah, there's a tendency to view biography as this sort of categorical, there's your life story.
Yeah.
But it's an act of interpretation, no matter what sources you rely on. And Wild Nights with Emily had full access to the Harvard University Press archive, so it's very much drawing on the accepted literature around her life. As I say, I really loved A Quiet Passion. And there are those...
Oh my god, isn't she?
Yeah.
There are those two scenes that I thought, you know, staggering. Some of the best filmmaking I've seen in a very, very long time.
And also, I'm not convinced that the guy who plays her brother isn't just Terrence Stamp as a, like a time. Seriously, the resemblance is uncanny.
Yeah, isn't it?
Uncanny.
That scene where they're all aged in the photographer's studio. It's, I nearly fell off my couch. Not lying down. It's really, really something.
Yeah.
That was pretty much all I got to. I did also get the chance to watch one. My DVR was giving out that it was 99% full, so I looked at something that was HD, and it was, I'd recorded it off Film 4. It's a UK horror shot in Ireland called In Fear, and it's terrible. It's, you know,
I've had that on my watch list for, years.
I recorded it. The reason I recorded it was because I'd heard good things, and then I got around to watching
it. Which one?
In Fear. So it's a Scottish guy, and I think she's an English woman. They take off to Ireland to go to a music festival, but en route they decide.
Oh,
that's what
I'm
saying.
Oh, okay.
They decide.
It's from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., everyone.
Yeah.
It's also the lead actor from Lost River.
Oh yeah. Lest we forget.
Never forget, Jake.
They decide to stop off for one night along the way at the Killarney House Hotel, which they can't find because the sounds all point in different directions. So they're driving around.
That actually does happen.
All the time. But it has this quality of horror tourism where somebody from a different jurisdiction makes a film over here and just, you know, innately,
like hostels
are terrifying, and mostly it's the people. You know, there's no supernatural forces here. It's actually it's Killarney. I don't know where it is, but I thought it was Killarney. I thought it was Killarney for a while, and then I was like, "It's very flat for Kerry." So I'm not sure where they shot.
I like the idea that they would pay actual attention to the geography of Killarney if they can't pronounce it properly.
It's a different word.
Oh,
Killarney.
Oh,
it's written on the sign throughout. They've just made up a place. There is some sort of impressive technical work in there, in that a lot of it takes place in the car because they're terrified and they refuse to get out of it. And you know, the camera work, it's interesting how they deal with that, but then it just goes full on horror. And actually, you mentioned Eden Lake, it's kind of like that, but awful.
83% on Rotten Tomatoes for Owner.
You're kidding me.
Really? How many critics?
There were actually two.
I did.
52.
It's Bill Murray in it somewhere.
Trunk shot. There's Bill Murray.
Hey, guys.
I didn't have much time. You know, there's... And I actually scanned a couple of reviews. A lot of people saying, oh, it's impressive technical stuff. And I think there are a lot of UK critics praising a UK director. And many of them said the word specifically, calling card. And fine, it is. But as a film, it doesn't hold together well. And I was bored senseless.
All right.
You want to end on an upper thing, Darren?
So I took advantage of the guys' trip down to Galway and the week off to be very constructive and watch The Incredibles 2 and Once Upon a Time in America twice in the space of 48 hours each. Very productive day.
You were insane.
I watched both the extended cut of Once Upon a Time in America,
which is 3 days long,
and the extended cut of Once Upon a Time in America, the one that premiered at Cannes a couple of years ago, with an additional 27 minutes, including Louise Fletcher, who was famously credited in the original theatrical cut of the film, didn't appear in that or the original extended version either.
Okay. Was the extended version pulled? What? Like, wasn't there an issue with... There was an issue with the...
The issue of the rights. So this is a movie that has so many versions that you can check. Originally, it was cut to... It was basically... He turned in a five-hour cut of the film. He originally planned to make it 6 hours, split it in two, and release it in two halves. Studio said no. They premiered it. There was a disastrous premiere screening in which the projector broke down 10 minutes into the film. The audience were forced to stand outside in the snow, and understandably, when they came back in and watched the three-hour film or four-hour film, left very scathing remarks in their comment cards, leading the studio to basically decide to cut it. They cut that 3.5-hour, 4-hour cut down to 2 hours. In doing so...
Wouldn't have left much, I wouldn't have thought, in there.
In doing so, they completely removed any non-linear storytelling aspect of it.
Ooh.
Which, if you've seen the film, is a bit of a demand. Mm. So everything's told entirely in sequence. Robert De Niro doesn't appear for an hour of a 2-hour film, which is quite impressive.
I thought this was
better. That's an incredibly bad idea.
There's a famous... it gets better. Famously, there's a sequence at the end where... And this doesn't spoil much. Where he's meeting with James Woods at a certain point in the film, and James Woods shows him a secret button that opens a secret door that leads out of his house.
Yeah.
That scene, that sequence of that scene was cut from the 2-hour version to get it down to 2 hours. But it still retains the scene where Robert De Niro, despite never being in this house or room before, walks up to a panel on the wall and just pushes through it and finds a secret door. The original release of it was so botched that they ended up, they couldn't get any Morricone properly qualified for the Oscars. For the soundtrack.
And which is an incredible soundtrack.
It's a great soundtrack.
Beautiful.
So I watched the extended cut, which was the one that was released a couple years later in Europe, and I watched the extended cut, which was the one that was released after Cannes, which runs 4 hours and 4 hours and 9 minutes.
You're a goddamn madman, Looney.
It's hell. Being honest, the reason that I did it is because I'm never going to watch it again. It's a beautiful film. It's also a really scuzzy film in some ways. It's I adore Leone. I think Leone is one of the best directors who ever worked in cinema. His framing, his composition, huge influence. Once Upon a Time in America sort of demonstrates the limits of his craft and his technique, particularly as a writer, and particularly with regards to his writing of female characters. It has this weird, like, fantasy quality to it, where all the women who exist in this 4-hour narrative are Madonnas or whores.
Yes.
And it's like, it's not as if he only had so much space in which to explore these characters. He just keeps introducing more of them and pushing the idea that they're even more like Madonnas or whores for 4 hours. I watched it for the first time when I was 14 and I felt really scuzzy afterwards. I watched it now and I feel just as scuzzy. It's beautiful. It's stunning. It's absolutely amazing. It looks fantastic.
Yeah, it's a beautiful film.
It captures New York beautifully. It has, like, the transitions, the scene transitions through history are amazing, where it cuts and it uses musical cues in order to jump between the ages. It has this almost dreamlike quality to it, where it's
the opium den is used as that kind of
thing. It has this sort of, like, this quality that you associate with, like, modern HBO storytelling and also, you know, various other non-linear
stories. Extremely influential in that regard.
In the way that it tells its story. It is beautiful, it's just, I never want to see it again. And I figured that if I was going to watch it one
more time. Watching two or three cuts you watched in the space of
2 days?
That would help explain a lot.
Yeah.
Give it a few years.
And then it's out back in. If you are going to do that, you may as well give the 4-hour, 9-minute cut. They do something interesting where the footage that they used was degraded.
Hmm.
So they actually altered the original footage around it in order to integrate the footage better.
Makes sense.
So it changes the color grading on it, which is weird because it feels like you're watching you're seeing images that you recognize but that you don't. It has an uncanny quality to it. There's also, like, a sense, I can't tell if the scenes are meant to be silent or if they just lost the soundtrack as well. But there are, like, extended 5-minute sequences that play entirely silent with the Morricone score over it. So it's an interesting experiment. Outside of that, I rewatched Game Night, which is still fantastic this time around.
Really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Edge of 17 is on Netflix, so I watched that. It's fantastic.
I love that one.
I liked it. It's okay.
I was astounded when I watched it with people. I described it as a coming-of-age comedy, and...
It's not. It's very dark, though. There's a lot of quite troubling subject matter in there.
Okay, I thought it was hilarious.
My sister found it very depressing. Because I remember I was going to watch it, and I was like, yeah, this looks like fun, and she was like, it's very bleak. It's very bleak.
Okay.
And I can see where she's coming from.
Yeah, no, the people I watched it with had a similar reaction to it. And I was like, why are you people not laughing? This is hilarious. Which is very disconcerting. Makes me worry a little bit about myself.
Well, I think some of the things they portray are just captured maybe a little too realistically, so I feel like it might strike a chord with some people, and that chord will be an uncomfortable one.
Yeah, well, I mean, the social anxiety and stuff like that, and all the sense of being a teenager and the world and seeming apocalyptic. I thought it captured that sort of sense very well, and I thought it captured it sort of in a nice, sort of relatively self-aware manner, where you get a sense of at once this seeming like an impossible apocalyptic sort of situation, while also having the perspective of realizing that this is, you're a teenager and everything will feel like an apocalypse.
Good performances.
Great performances. Hayley Steinfeld is amazing.
She's great.
She is fantastic. Woody Harrelson is very, very well cast.
Yeah.
I particularly love one of my favorite lines, one of my favorite jokes of last year or the year before when it was released, which is the when he reads the infamous Facebook message, which is filled with all sorts of lurid and graphic details. He takes a moment, he looks at her, and he observes, you really need to watch out for run-on sentences, which is just beautiful. The cinema cracked up, I cracked up when I rewatched it. It's fantastic. And finally, I rewatched, because of my show Solidarity with Jay, I rewatched the first two Fast and Furious films.
Yes!
Jay, are you doing the experiment?
Yes.
At last! We've talked about this in the past. It's finally happening.
It's ongoing.
How far in are you?
I'm two films in. I've watched the first two.
Oh, you're Tokyo Drift next.
Oh, yay.
That's so funny. Why are you going to be excited about
it? Weirdly, Tokyo Drift is the only one I've seen. So I've never watched it.
I've only seen one. It wasn't that one.
Which one have you seen?
Six.
Oh, interesting.
I love Six. Six is my favorite.
Six is...
Listen to yourself.
Six is the most insane...
I love the idea of the
Jay one. I'm talking about
the tank?
No, the other one.
The runway.
The runway.
Yeah.
The runway.
They calculated that runway would have to be like 47 miles long.
Yeah, this is why it
would have to for the plane to
in order for the climax of the sixth film to work.
Yeah.
And it's great because when
what have I let myself in for?
He's looking number two, let's not forget.
When the chase
scene. It's not the most implausible part of that movie, though. The most implausible part of that movie is that Michelle Rodriguez could somehow overpower Gina Carano in physical combat.
Oh, not that. No way.
Let's not go there, people. But anyway.
The best thing about that chase sequence with the plane taking off on the 47-mile runway, the fact that once they stop the plane, they just pull up and the runway ends.
Yeah.
It's like, thank goodness, we ended it right now. But yeah, so I watched the first two, which is an interesting experiment, because like the thing about the Fast and Furious movies is that they go insane at a certain point. They are now superhero movies where the superheroes are cars, basically, is what they are at this moment in time, whereas they begin as this weird, grotty, like, late 90s street racing sort of thing. It's this, you know, urban western about men who have nowhere to go, who drive their cars around in circles because they can't find any purpose in their lives, and they live their life one quarter mile at a time. You know, and they're literally, like, there's a moment where they're ambushed by a gang of outlaws, and their car is blown up because it's carrying nitroglycerin, which is a sequence straight from a western. The introduction of Vin Diesel, where he's shot from the back, sitting down, eating, and bringing peace to a battle outside the tuna shop where he's
working. What did you put in that sandwich?
There's, like, it's very much this low-key, like, western, sort of late 90s existential ennui, like, where are we as a culture? And we're afraid of, like, the nightmare is the breakdown of society in Los Angeles at the end of the western frontier, where you've got all these urban street gangs who are, like, the Vietnamese led by Johnny Tran, or the Mexicans led by Hector, I think he might be Alonzo. And you have this sort of, like, anxiety that runs through them, the sense of purposelessness. And the reveal, and I don't think this is too much of a reveal because we, you know, everybody's probably
because
seen
it's
the
Point
movie.
Break.
I haven't seen it.
But it's the reveal, like, you spend the...
It doesn't matter,
okay.
Phil. It won't ruin anything.
I won't lie, you're not
the storyline is exactly like Point Break.
It is exactly
if
like...
If you see Point Break, you know what happens.
Point Break, but they couldn't afford to remake it, and also there are cars instead of surfboards.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what it is. And it's yeah, it's interesting. And then I watched the Fast and Furious 2, which is interesting.
Too Fast,
don't
Too
call
Furious, excuse you.
Come on.
Too Fast, Too Furious.
Yeah.
Oh, Ronan.
I'm a purist who's never seen this.
Which is amazing, because you can tell that 9/11 happened in the space between the two movies. Because the first Fast and Furious movie is like this ambiguous, like, ride to nowhere. There's no moral certainty. There's no... Everybody's lost, and there's no sense of purpose. And then all of a sudden, the second one comes along. It's like, okay, we're working for the cops, and we're taking down a drug dealer who's smuggling drugs into the country. And it's
but yeah. we're still driving storm of cars.
Yeah, I love how the second one comes up with these. It's the Miami Vice plot, right down to starring Cole Hauser as Tom Berenger. But you have this ridiculous necessity to have like race scenes in it. There's a moment where the drug dealer is auditioning people to run drugs for him, and he suggests the only way that he could possibly do that is to have like a race across town and a race back across town. You're like, yeah. What, how does this work?
You have to deliver drugs fast.
I don't think speed is the thing, though. I like the idea that you just get drugs there by running really quickly. But yeah,
I'm surprised you didn't make a joke about speed there, but anyway.
Hey. But yeah, so that was what I
wanted. In terms of those two movies, I've watched them kind of one after another, pretty much. I kind of liked the first one.
It's
shaky as all hell initially. I'm like, oh my god, this is terrible. And then it kind of kicks off and things happen and it's exciting and it's loud. And it's a terrific truck car chase sequence at that last. Again, similar to the runway, it sounds like.
Are people asking for much more than that from these films? I think that's perfect.
I saw the film when I was 12 and I was like, this is perfect. This is like
that's fine.
Everything I was looking for.
Yeah, and like, and it is a thing. I'm no issue with that as such. But The Fast and the Furious 2, and I'm calling it that. I'm going to call them each one of them 3, 4, 5, 6, because I'm the purest in numerical terms.
Fast 2, Furious 2, please.
There's good moments in it. Like, there's a great car landing in a boat sequence, which is really good.
But that's you've described the moment. It lasts all of 2 seconds.
Yeah, I know.
Like, that's it.
That's all I got.
There's no building.
But it has Eve Mendes, which always helps.
And I like the Miami Vice-ness of it. And
the Blues Brothers-ness of it.
Yeah.
Where it brings about 100 cop cars into it for no reason. But it's not particularly great. And it really, really misses Vin Diesel. Like, it really misses him. And I never thought it'd say those words.
But he
does. No, he does,
yeah. Proto Dwayne Johnson.
I agree.
I don't know why his career didn't quite reach those heights.
Because what did he do? Instead of this was the...
Oh, the Chronicles of Riddick, wasn't it?
Yeah, Chronicles of Riddick, I think.
But I mean, Pitch Black is also good.
I haven't seen Pitch Black.
Like the first Fast and Furious movie, uses Vin Diesel perfectly in that it doesn't give him that many lines.
Mm-hmm.
The issues of Chronicle of Riddick and some of the later Fast and Furious films is that they think he's an actor.
Yeah. But they don't ask too much of him.
No,
in fairness.
But I wasn't gone on the second one, I have to say.
The second one is the worst of them, I think.
Ooh, interesting.
I have a soft spot for Tokyo Drift, and it has a lot to do with... You probably won't notice it the first time you watch it. If you revisit it...
I love your optimism.
Films,
yeah.
Then you will have a soft spot for reasons that I won't discuss.
I like to see the first time. Have you met Jay?
I like the idea that... Man, anytime you talk about a film, you're saying, I have a soft spot for them. Always give me a red flag. It's like, if somebody else saw it, means I know it's crap, but I really like it.
Because it is objectively crap.
Yeah,
but,
okay.
But if there's something very endearing about it.
I think you probably recognize that quality in the first one.
I think they're layered and nuanced. I think the multiple viewings will be required.
There won't be multiple viewings. I wouldn't imagine. But it might have cumulative effect.
In the chronology, Tokyo Drift takes place after the sixth film. So
don't start that with me. Don't tell me that.
Yeah.
I don't do that. I have to watch them in the order they're made.
The ending of Tokyo Drift is retconned in 6, so yeah, you should probably watch 3 first.
My head hurts.
Why didn't I just watch the Transformers film?
Yes. This is like Primer. There's a diagram on the wall to help Jay work through this.
This is not like Primer, I can assure you.
While Jay is working through that, let's move on to talking about the weekend film news.
Do it.
So the guys were down at the Gully Film Club last week, as you probably heard on the podcast, covering the films, long and short, that were airing there. The FLAS announced its award winners for the for this year in question. So the best international short documentary went to Jock.
I'll catch that.
Do chip in if you've seen it.
Yeah.
I don't think I've seen any of the award winners whatsoever.
I saw a few of the award winners. I was really glad to see two awards go to Boy Saint, which was by
Oh, you were saying that was good.
Cinematography,
best
first fiction short. By far the best film overall I saw there.
Nice.
It's really, really fantastic. It's got this, I talked about it a bit last week, but it's got this sort of almost Malick-like style where it's, in theory, an adaptation of a poem that has these sort of expressive shots over it. But it's beautiful camera work. Really glad to see it win that cinematography award. I don't know what its plans are for further screenings and festivals, but it's absolutely wonderful.
If you can catch it.
Absolutely fantastic.
Other highlights include the best Irish feature documentary going to Ross Whittaker's Katie, the Katie Taylor documentary.
Yeah, I think Niall saw it. We didn't get to it. I was seeing something else, I think.
Ross
Whittaker is a fine filmmaker. I imagine it's good.
Yeah. Also, the best Irish feature in association with Volta went to The Dig, which I'm very, very excited about. Again,
Niall said it was very good.
And he said it's right up my street, is what he said to me, which always fills me with hope.
And the best Irish first feature went to Cellar Door, which is an interesting
not choice. Up Niall Street.
Well, yeah, it was,
to say the least.
It's an interesting choice, I believe, because I think many people were expecting Metal Heart to take it.
Yeah, and there was a few walkouts apparently as well. So it'd be interesting to see what kind of reaction or what kind of release thing they have for it.
Apparently, the ending is this the one with the ending that's quite divisive, or am I
thinking? It might be that.
So, yeah. So it'd be interesting to see how that plays. But yeah, so those are films to look out for in the coming weeks and months. In other news, Irish film abroad, Liam O'Mokan's Lost and Found, which I think we discussed a couple of weeks ago as a new release, has basically been picked up by Film 4 in the UK. So it's basically been touring around at the moment, obviously the premiere at the FLA as well. But it's currently screening in Dublin and Cork. It'll expand to Galway and Mayo from July 20th. There are Q&As with Liam O'Mokan Monday in Galway and Tuesday in Mayo. But it got picked up by Film 4, so they're looking at possibly distributing it in the UK in later 2018. It looks like it should be worth it. I've heard very good things about it, and it's still screening, actually, as well, which indicates that there's a lot of interest out there as well for it.
Good stuff.
In other news, there's a Pixar season coming from the Lighthouse.
Yay.
Which is great. So,
I guess.
Fine. All the magic is gone. But yeah,
we are too old.
We are all too old, and the sequels are kind of disheartening a little bit, I suspect.
Toy Story 2 and 3.
I know.
They're saying.
They're showing Finding Nemo.
They're showing all of them.
Nemo's magnificent.
Over August 10th through 26th. So they're running through the entire sort of gamut. And I think they're actually pairing. They're pairing the films and their sequels. So if you want to see Finding Nemo and Finding Dory, that's screening on August 11th. Monsters, Inc. and Monsters University is showing on...
Monsters University is not good at all.
Well, you can just go see the first one, then.
Finding Dory's not great either.
I think you can buy individual tickets.
Oh, no, I know you can. I'm just saying that they're not the double bills I would want to see.
I've seen a ton of Pixar movies.
Don't worry, Jay. We have the perfect triple bill for you on August 12th. Cars at noon. Cars 2 at 2:30.
And the
Cars 3 at 5 p.m.
Some parent is going to be dragged to that.
They're massively popular. Like that's why they're
crying in the toilets.
That's why there were three of them. It's because they were the original sort of like Pixar offering to Disney because they're merchantable. Because you can sell cars.
Yeah.
Also,
my
friend's toddler son is obsessed with Cars. Like, if I have to hear that film one more time, I'm actually going to go insane.
I like the idea of the characters. They're very simple. They're very endearing in that way. But yeah, I've only seen the first one.
I tried to watch the first one. I found it idiotic.
It's
it
not
bored.
Bad.
Sorry.
Jay's home
never
on kids cinema. That's like
idiotic.
You idiot kids.
Idiotic compared to other Pixar's.
Yeah.
Up to that point, at least.
That's it exactly. Like I have very little problem with the Cars movies because the Cars movies exist to justify doing stuff like Inside Out, WALL-E. And Up.
I didn't know with Pixar had to justify doing good films because that's what they've done, and
they've
always made money.
They've been bought by the mouse. They kind
the
of
mouse
do
makes
it.
Money regardless. Exactly. You can throw any old shite and people go and see it.
But there's still the fact that they can still get we can still get an Inside Out from them once in a while. I mean, there's still
true.
It's just
I quite like Coco though. It was decent.
I haven't seen Coco, but I heard good
Coco
things.
Solid.
Not great, but it's decent.
Seen Coco either.
It's a really good Disney film.
Yeah, I mean, I've got no objections to a version of like Doc Hollywood based around Cars, but it's just a bit too simple. Really. It doesn't have like the heartstring tugger moments.
Also, John Lasseter. Anyway, let's move on.
That delightful note, we're going to talk about the top 10. At number 10 Woo-hoo! This week is The Secret of Maribou. Which is the horror film, directed by Sergio G. Sanchez.
You were a big fan, I believe.
Oh, I absolutely adored this. No, I did not. You can't hear the sound of gritted teeth on the podcast, it's an interesting idea. It's interesting because it's written by Sergio Sanchez. It's not adapted. When I first saw it, I thought it was like an adaptation of like a short story or a novella because it has that like prose gothic horror quality to it. It's got like a central conceit which would work very well on the printed page, but which would be a challenge to make work on screen
Kind of like the Lodgers?
The Lodgers is better. Lodgers is much, much better. The secret
that doesn't
of,
bode well.
The Secret of Marrowbone is pretty bad. It's really, really... It's got no sense of tone. It jumps between being bright, colorful, and cheerful, and being oppressive and dark and gothic. It's got a soundtrack that tells you exactly how you should be feeling at every moment. And not just in the jump scares. In, like, moments of the kids wandering through the pastoral landscape, it's like, oh, you better enjoy this moment because something horrible is going to happen to them. Except it doesn't. For 10 minutes. It's like, I get it. If you're going to signpost, at least move quickly. It's got this sort of horrible... It's got this... Like, it's got a really... interesting central twist, but it doesn't do anything with it, and it's incredibly obvious if you are at all familiar with the works that the film is drawing on.
Yeah.
In that the film is very clearly building towards something. Once you figure that out, and you figure out its frame of reference, it's very clear what it's building towards. It's also let down disappointingly by the cast, which includes Charlie Heaton and Anya Taylor-Joy,
is
a shame.
Yes, that's some great, like, she's in it, and George McKay, they're both fine actors.
They seem lost. And I don't think the issue is them. I suspect the film is the issue is the edit or the direction, because it often seems like the film is caught between two extremes, being this sort of, like, retro 1960s melodrama and being this, like, gothic, like, haunted house ghost story, and it never quite finds the right tone for them.
I just like the idea of Anya Taylor-Joy as our scream queen of the moment, between this and Split and The Witch. People, if you haven't seen The Witch, go see The Witch.
And New Mutants and everything like that.
The Witch is also on Netflix.
Oh, go, please.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Oh, you just said that. She's in that Mutants.
I've never seen Split. That's all I got to say.
Either, and I wouldn't mind. It's fine.
Thanks, Roland.
I feel like
you're perfectly serviceable film.
I feel like I'd have to see it again to form a concrete opinion on it, but I've never felt the urge to watch it again. It's
very
strange.
No, I very much felt like once was enough. James McAvoy has a ball with it, but he's sort of shooting for a different tone than the film itself is.
Okay, see, this just makes me want to watch it more. This could be a car crash.
It's too good to be a car crash, which is almost disappointing at times.
Being a Cheyenne woman film.
Well, that's exactly like it's.
I've seen enough car crashes from that.
Good as his best, but also not as fun as his worst.
The problem with his worst is when they're not being fun. They are horribly, horribly dull.
Mm-hmm. That's it. Yeah.
So I don't know. I could deal with something not being a car crash as long as it's not dull.
I mean, this isn't dull. I wouldn't describe it.
Okay, no, it's not dull. It's, you know, I was interested
in high grades from that.
And I like James McAvoy a lot, so yeah.
Here we go. All right. At number 9, Adrift. This is cinema. Balthazar. I'm being honest, I thought it was grand. I quite enjoyed it. It has a nice sense of scale, but it surprises me that this is still in the top 10.
Mm, he does scale well. And his films rip people in all the time.
Yeah. Which is impressive. I'm glad to see that, because it's outlasted of, like, Solo, for example.
Yeah.
But it came out after Solo.
It did come out after Solo, but again, it's
a much smaller film.
It's a much, much smaller film. Like, it's,
I suppose.
Patrick, or Pug Actually, which I haven't seen.
I thought Pug Actually was the tagline.
Pug Actually is the deadline.
I've never heard of this.
It's one of those things where they've got like an animal that's famous for no real reason, and they just make that the star as a load of.
It's an actual famous animal.
Is it?
I don't know.
I assume so. Why on earth am I interested in a dog film? Otherwise,
maybe we
should. Is it on a talent?
We don't know anything. About
I thought he was on a talent show or something. I know they did ones like that before, but is this dog like famous for some reason?
A dog has got to be famous for you to be interested in a dog film. Lassie wasn't famous until after Lassie.
I know, but we're talking about a low budget British export here. I have to have some kind of reason to do this. I don't
some emotion.
Otherwise, the most undemanding child won't like this, I don't think. I saw a poster for it walking through a shopping centre last week. What is this?
But I mean, if it had been anything other than a pug, I probably would have stopped at the poster and oohed and awed and gotten a ticket.
I can't find much on the dog's film.
You know what? You're already putting in cards on the shepherd. Move on.
This seems like a lot of work.
The best line I've ever heard. Can't find much on the dog's filmography.
At number 7, it's Sicario 2. Day of the Soldado.
I didn't like Sicario 1. Who asked for this?
People that love Sicario.
There's apparently a ton of people who didn't like Sicario 1. I was under the impression...
They're all coming out lately, aren't they?
I was under the impression that loads of us liked it, but apparently, no, we were the minority the whole time.
My God, I've been slagging off Villeneuve for years. Like, hasn't anybody been listening to me?
Yeah.
Is there nothing you like?
All I do is slag off Villeneuve. I've been doing it for years. It's a hate campaign at this stage.
I bet you don't get subtweeted half as much as I do, though.
I'd be disappointed. I really hope I am.
Alright, I think I've been seeing Blade Runner 2, so
don't.
You're not missing.
Dude. Yeah, you're not.
I mean, it's beautiful.
It looks beautiful.
Absolutely stunning.
But I feel like it's the type of film where I'd like to see some of the shots as paintings I could appreciate with none of the film attached.
It's actually a really great film to leave on in the background of a party.
That's not
Philip,
a selling point.
I got three words for you. Dull as shite.
Thank you, Jay.
The alternative
poster. That's all I can say.
I think that's going on the.
That's the tagline. That's the tagline of the film.
Beautifully photographed shot.
Yeah, but then.
So they did polish it.
I like
the.
Hey.
I lost it. It never left me.
At number six, it's Dublin Old School.
Oh, Jesus, yolks and drugs and things, you know what I mean? Like,
that's what the fuck accent is that?
That's all this is. That's all that film looks like to me. Jesus.
Please stop doing an accent. Stop doing an accent.
I like how you're mitigating the accent through the criticism.
I'm not.
Also, that,
I'm craving it up.
I thought that went, Jay, that went a bit Liam Gallagher as well. I was like, what the hell was that? Yes, you are.
There are some who feel there's some overlap between quite a flat Dublin accent and a Liverpool accent.
There is.
I don't hear it personally.
There is a little bit.
I feel like
there is in my version.
Something in his version just made me think.
Dublin Old School's grand.
Yeah, and it's doing very, very well for itself. Yeah. It's made €143,000 to date.
It does look a bit more energetic and happier than most relatively independent Irish fare that comes out.
That's the thing, and often people always say that Irish people don't go to see Irish films. We turn in for comedies a lot of the time.
Yeah, and when they make them.
Yeah,
when they make them.
It's okay, like, it's worth seeing. I wouldn't put anybody off it, but I wasn't as gone as most of them. But then, so say to me.
I live in Tallaght and I haven't seen it, which feels like
sacrilege.
I'm like, do we need to see it or do I just need to go for a walk?
We're not meddling.
Hey, I'm Dublin 10 as well. I understand. I know what you're talking about.
D24 for the win.
At number 5,
we are the last postcode.
At number 5, starring Galway Film Fly guest Marissa Tomei, The First Purge.
Which I didn't get to meet, actually. I'm actually disgusted. Yeah.
I mean, despite
Niall met her, but I did not. Yeah. Despite my constant harassing.
And,
no,
and
I didn't.
And her pledge to get her to host the podcast.
Yeah, I did. I wanted her on the podcast.
I wouldn't object. I love Marissa.
She's great. She's great.
She's great.
But yeah, apparently The First Purge is quite okay as they go.
Probably not going to see
it. I've seen some very mixed reviews. They basically say timely but messy.
Yeah, but I mean, it is again, it's a low.
It's a Purge movie.
I really liked the Purge movie with Grillo. Which one is that?
Well, it's two of them, isn't it? It's 2 and 3. It's the
third one, that's the one I like.
The second one, I think.
Okay.
Anarchy is on
the second Anarchy and then Election Day, yeah.
That one, yeah.
Election Day is alright.
Someone describing it as the best Punisher movie they've ever seen.
No. The Punisher movie by Lexi Alexander is amazing. It's incredible. Oh, that's
Purge
Warzone.
The Purge Anarchy is not actually
a There's the Dolph Lundgren one.
There's the
Thomas Jane one.
And there's the Ray Stevens one.
Yeah.
The Lexi Alexander.
That's a brilliant film. I only watched it about 2 months ago. It's incredible.
I've seen clips. It's bloody as hell.
It really is. Fantastic.
But it's so well done.
And it's got a sense of humour. It's not that sort of Garth Ennis sort of dark sense
and
of
humour quality. It has an all-timer shot in it, which if you haven't seen, you should see just for the...
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Like I'm rarely agog sitting on the sofa, but I was agog.
It is dazzling. It has been, I think Roger Ebert described it as the best Steven Seagal movie ever made. But it's like, imagine if a Steven Seagal movie was good, you would end up with this.
You're
it's almost impossible.
I would suggest that it's one of the best superhero films ever made.
I wouldn't go quite that far.
I would.
I think it's very good.
And I recommend everyone see it.
And I would say the second best Punisher movie ever made is The Equalizer, starring Denzel Washington.
And that's not very good.
It's not very good either. Ah, it's grand. It delivers what it promises. At number 4, it's Ocean's 8.
Yay. I still haven't got to it. Hopefully now Galway's.
But I thought
you
love Sandra Bullock.
I do. Galway.
I've been
holding
Galway, on
to this
since the start of the podcast.
Oh, I'll get to it. It's on my list.
But yeah, it's charming.
That's Bullock and Cate Blanchett. I mean,
I think it's very fun.
It is perhaps a light. I think that it needs a stronger director and maybe a stronger script. But the cast, you're there to hang out with the cast. And the cast are great. At number 3, Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom.
No.
I saw Jurassic World. It was more than enough for me.
quite like Fallen Kingdom. It's much, much better than it needs to be.
Is it better than Jurassic World?
Of course it is.
That's a low bar, I grant you, but I've seen the reviews.
Things that I shoot on my my camera phone are better than Jurassic World.
So what changed?
The director.
That helps.
Yeah, J.A. Goyna. But it's actually shot like a horror film, and it has an extended Nosferatu homage in its final act.
In a dinosaur movie.
Yeah, come on, tell me you're not interested.
I can see problems here.
Yeah, but tell me you're not interested. See, somebody in Universal like said, this movie's going to make $1 billion.
And our mummy flops, so we need a monster movie somehow featuring Dracula.
That's
to
it.
To be fair, some of the stuff you said about it, Darren, does make me slightly curious. But then we also disagree on a lot of things. So I'm kind of like, just because you saw all of this in here does not mean I'm going to see it.
That's potentially a long way to fall.
Which is difficult. So I'm like, I think I'll err on the side of caution. And
I'm with you, if only because, you know.
If it shows up on TV at some stage and I'm not doing anything, I might put it on.
I feel like I've made a difference in the world.
I give it until like the first break and see how it goes. Mm-hmm.
It's a shame. The second half is much more interesting. Anyway, at number two, it's Skyscraper. One of the new releases this week, directed by Ross and Marshall Thurber and starring The Rock.
From the director of Dodgeball.
I like Dodgeball.
I do, actually.
Yeah, I have not seen it.
Remember, if you can dodge a wrench, etc.
Yes, Skyscraper is really disappointing, both financially and in terms of creatively.
Are we seeing The Rock? Is that the question?
I think he's reaching a certain saturation level. I like The Rock as much as I like
Jennifer Lawrence syndrome.
Well, he had five films in the past 18 months.
Yes.
No, that's too much.
That's a lot of uncut.
Especially
rock
when
right
a
there
lot of them are kind of the same film, just reshot with slightly different plots.
Yeah,
I saw San Andreas. That put me off wanting to see this.
San Andreas
anyway
was pretty bad. I thought San Andreas was the worst film I'd seen in 2015 until I saw Jurassic World.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Jurassic World is abominable. But I mean, the issue.
But San Andreas is pretty damn bad too.
San Andreas is, but at least it has Paul Giamatti trying.
If Paul Giamatti doing a weird Richard Dreyfuss impression.
That's it, exactly. And
I'm using the word bro, unironically.
Oh, no. All that's
a little bit interesting.
No.
Also, The Rock is a terrible person in San Andreas.
Oh, yeah,
he
makes
a save. What do you call him?
A search and rescue.
Search and rescue helicopter, and just fucks off in it.
just to save his own family.
Oh no!
Well, this is the thing with them. It's kind of interesting, but then Skyscraper has that as well, where Skyscraper is nominally a disaster movie. In that it's about a building, it's the Towering Inferno meets Die Hard in theory, right?
But Die Hard already was a Towering Inferno. Why do you need to mash the two together somehow?
It gets better because you lump a superhero movie in on top of it. It's a movie that eschews like the sort of dynamic that you expect from a disaster movie, which is a whole bunch of people who are trapped together in unusual circumstances and forced to survive as an ensemble. I mean, even Independence Day has like Will Smith and Jeff Goldblum and this sort of vague supporting cast, whereas Skyscraper is pretty much, it's only The Rock.
I'm surprised you didn't just remake the Towering Inferno in the context of get a load of old actors from the 70s, 80s, 90s and stick them in different rooms they had in the original Towering Inferno.
Really,
I would watch the hell out of that.
Whereas,
Gene Hackman on retirement.
But they looked at Skyscraper, they looked at the Towering Inferno and said, what this needs is a superhero.
Taller tower.
Yeah, and he literally, like, the great shot of him jumping off the crane defying the laws of physics.
How can it be a great shot? I'm sure it's just CGI to shit.
Yeah, when I say great, and it's like, you know, like...
Your podcast seeing is rated PG-13.
Yeah, when I say great, there's a difference between great and good.
Yes,
in the sense of scale,
yes,
as opposed to...
And also in terms of
great meaning larger immense, we use it in the pejorative sense.
Thank you, Phil. I missed you, Phil.
No one misses me.
But it's also the most ridiculously, absurdly hyper masculine, overcompensating movie ever because it features.
Because it's a really tall tower. Am I right or am I right?
Oh,
yeah, right.
It gets better. He jumps from a crane at maximum extension to mount the giant skyscraper.
Please stop this line of reasoning. I don't want to hear any more of this.
Okay, fine.
Please stop. Also, can I mention, just in terms of Rock, Jumanji Welcome to the Jungle is terrific. That's all I've got to say. And he's great. And Jack Black is great. And it's a really fun movie. Honestly, he's great in it. Jack Black's terrific in it.
I like that we're escalating this.
This happens occasionally where I watch something and go,
that was
surprisingly good.
One more absurd season like that, I may wet myself. Be careful.
Sorry.
It's very warm.
That's my excuse. I'm going with that. Right, let's go.
At number one, it's Incredibles 2, surprising absolutely nobody, making €800,000 in its opening weekend.
That's incredible.
Can I assume that, I know I haven't been on this in a while, but I assume the trend of animation doing really, really well has not stopped.
It's never abated. It never stops. It's just usually two a week.
It's all the bloody kids.
Too many children.
Too many children in this country.
Yeah.
We just missed Romeo and Juliet for the last six weeks already.
It's gone!
About 2 years. It's been in the cinema for about 2 years.
You never really know.
It's not a long story show.
Yeah.
Which at least is not an animated kids movie, to be fair.
I'm sure it's pretty animated, though.
But yeah, so Incredibles 2 is that.
I wouldn't have heard that many success.
Brad Bird's new film, which is, it's astounding. It's an interesting effort. It's
Jesus, that's not much of a sell there.
Yeah.
One of the best action movies of the summer. It's got wonderful propulsion, it's got great set pieces, it's got a wonderful sense of physics, a great sense of humor. It just doesn't have that sort of click that the original had. The
so
story,
essentially, it's not The Incredibles, but yes. That's pretty great.
Yeah, that's it exactly. It's one of the better films of the summer so far, while still not being as good as The Incredibles. It's an interesting situation to be in.
That is, it's still making a fortune. So
it absolutely is. Yeah, nobody's going to mind. It's going to be in the top 10 of the year easily, probably somewhere around 3 or 4, which is pretty damn good.
Proof's in the book.
But anyway, so let's move on to talking about what's coming out this week. Now, I think last week when you guys were in Galway, you may have missed this section.
We might have
too many films.
I think that's fair enough.
Yeah, so, that's grand. So we may catch up with some of the films that were out last week that we missed that didn't make the top 10.
Hit me.
So Ex Libris, the New York Public Library, 197
this released?
Directed is by Frederick Wiseman. Is this actually getting a release?
No.
I
don't think this is in the cinema in Ireland.
And I would know, because if this were out, I would actually be all over.
The UK, I think, got it. I don't think Ireland got it.
We haven't got it?
It's a pity, because it's Frederick Wiseman. You should be just all over that.
I still haven't seen a Wiseman film.
Go watch National Gallery.
I will.
Tidica Follies.
And then go watch Tidica.
Yeah, I'll have that
as well.
You gotta ease yourself.
It's 3 hours and 17 minutes.
That's short for Wiseman.
It's 4 hours.
Oh, you're not Berkeley. Oh, fantastic.
I saw all 4 hours in Yo-Yo Valley. Well worth it.
Nice. You could almost fly to Berkeley.
I really hope it wasn't in screen 2, because your neck would have been at you.
Screen 3.
Oh, I don't think any of the IFI screens are particularly comfortable.
The screen one I'm happy with.
The building needs such an overhaul.
They're getting new chairs in screen 1, actually.
They need them in screen 2!
They're
doing 2 as well. Oh, they're doing 2 as well? Oh, thank God.
Yeah, but they need to restructure screen 2.
There's a door halfway up the wall.
I
love that.
I quite like screen 2.
Anytime I bring someone there,
like,
give me a crick in the neck.
Yeah, I get it. I come out of screen 2 exhausted.
Screen
2. I'm old. This is what happens to you people.
Also, and last week, didn't make the top 10, but may still be screening in Ireland, is First Reformed, Paul Schrader's film.
It's certainly magnificent. Yeah, I caught this last night, and I really, really liked it. A lot of people have said, oh, it's Schrader doing Taxi Driver again, which it is in some ways, but it's doing a lot more than that.
It's more than Taxi Driver and Clerical Garb, which is an easy pitch.
Yeah.
And it is that to an extent, but then it goes some really dark and strange.
It does, and it's really impressive the way that Hawk carries all that. His face, I struck the entire thing, because Schrader shoots in the Academy Ratio and is constantly focusing on Hawk's face, which is now so wrinkled and so familiar that you can see his younger self in it, and it reflects the film's ideas of aging.
It reflects the idea that this is the role that Hawk has been waiting to play.
He's a great actor.
He's an undervalued and a great writer. And his talent to burn. Read any of his books.
I've read one of them years ago.
This is his best performance as a Calvinist priest who is having a crisis of faith, which is exacerbated when one of his parishioners, a pregnant woman played by Amanda Seyfried, urges him to counsel her husband because he wants her to terminate the pregnancy because he fears that the oncoming ecological catastrophe of global warming will make the planet uninhabitable. And instead,
not unreasonable.
No, there's a whole movement in climatological circles around this. It's a big ethical conversation.
Ironically, the people not having children in that situation will be the ones whose children will be most ready to deal with the apocalypses.
I'd say climate change is a factor that would influence my decision.
Oh yeah, no. I know, but I'm just pointing out that.
But the ironic thing in the film is that instead of, you know, him counselling the environmental activists, he actually starts to come around to the point of view of what on earth is going to happen to this planet.
It's really, really interesting the way that a lot of people have said that Schrader is kind of working off his old themes, of especially Breton. There are like threads from various different.
Oh yeah, like it's as if he's looking through his own book, Transcendental Sound, which has just been reissued, and using that and to finally make one of those films, which he has to a point.
He's very much doing his own thing, and I was fascinated by as much as there is Bresson in there. I think from the very get-go, immediately within about 5 minutes, I was like, "Oh, it's Winterlight."
It is,
and he is very open, like the framing, everything about it. He's absolutely invoking it very deliberately, and the way he transitions essentially from Winterlight to Taxi Driver into it's a sort of commentary on the way that our world is pressing those kind of outlooks together. In that,
The plot is the Bresson's Diary of the Country Priest. The look and the themes are absolutely Winterlight, but it's, you know, it's that kind of scuzzy Taxi Driver material pulled in that austere way. That it's that combination that I think is absolutely fascinating.
And he does amazing things with it. There is one sequence about halfway through that was just astonishing. For about 30 seconds, I was like, "Oh, you go in there," and I was like, "Oh, you have, and you've brought me with you."
It's when the austerity decides to take a sidestep.
Oh, yes, and it's a risky move.
Because I need you to see.
Oh, I don't know if you've seen it.
It's a really, really risky move, and I think the film takes a later one that's very much of a piece with that. And for me, they absolutely brought me along. I could hear people in the audience not being along with them. And
yeah.
I think there are.
Well, I went for them completely.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I know some people who didn't. And one person here is keeping very quiet about it.
Oh, I totally forgot you'd seen
that. I'm not a huge fan of it. I'm one of those people who is very much along the lines of, I feel like he did Taxi Driver. I feel like this is very much revisiting Taxi Driver in a way that is overtly literal. I feel like there's a way of doing this that would make a companion piece to Taxi Driver, and particularly like the first half of the film, I was kind of with it and on board. It's when it goes cuckoo banana land that I kind of lose it.
How mental does it go? Like, are we talking Hereditary levels?
No. Like, Schrader never loses control, but the issue is that it's. I don't want to get too specific, but in terms of the main character's arc and development, I think it goes to 11 in a way that doesn't necessarily fit the film, or didn't work for me with regards to what had been set up. But that's.
I just whipped the rug out from under me. Like,
yeah.
I'm with this. I'm going. Yeah.
I think.
Let's go on. Paul Schrader's wild ride.
What's fascinating is that it does gesture toward 11, but never quite goes there in the whole time.
It could have. There's a control.
But
not restraint. Control.
It's very much a kind of dialectic film. There's an extraordinary sequence early on where he has his first meeting with this with his prisoner, and he's played. I'm not sure the actor's name. Performance. And there's this increasing series of close-ups that get closer and closer, and you get that effect of Hawke's face, which has like this literal furrow down between his brows, and the person he's talking to, and it's just beautifully balanced. It's very, very dense scripting, but I think it's the visual aspect of things. Schrader shoots it remarkably well, and he's talked before about how, coming back to Taxi Driver, he wrote a very sort of spiritual film in a way, and Scorsese directed it expressionistically. And I think he takes a very different tack in his direction of this, and the tensions between those two are really fascinating.
Interesting. I've always seen Taxi Driver as a spiritual film as it turned out.
Yeah.
Me too.
Oh, absolutely. There's a camera.
Because
it's the very end.
Yeah. I mean, and Scorsese is like an incredibly spiritual director.
But like you describe
First Reformed,
Hawke's character in this, Toller, and the likes of Travis Bickle and other characters that
Light Sleeper. Do you remember Light Sleeper? Who
Villa
Defoe? Yeah.
First, great.
There's similar kind of things going on there as well.
I haven't seen Taxi Driver.
Really?
No, I don't particularly feel the need to watch it either. How am I going to get on with First Reformed?
If you don't want to watch Taxi Driver, you want to watch this then.
I like the sound of it though.
See how you go then.
Give it a go.
There's fewer child prostitutes by the sound of things.
Darren does a mental check in his head.
Yeah,
yes,
we're good.
Yes, there is.
I really, really loved it, and I used to cycle to the cinema, but I started walking home because I like how fewer films come all the way home with me. You know, the on the walk home.
Mm-hmm. You sort of process there.
Yeah,
yeah.
Fewer rules.
I'm going to walk. I don't lift your farm, man.
Yeah, exactly. And First Reform not only survived that, it survived like the entire rest of the day. I've been chewing over it constantly.
I saw it back in February, and it's been rolling around my mind so much since.
Yeah,
there's a lot of full review of that screening. Like,
oh, by the way, it is on scan. By the way,
yes,
so
it is.
I wholeheartedly recommend it.
My first one in a while, I must say.
I don't entirely agree with the conclusion, but I think it's fantastic. Like, it's a very good article. It's a really good article.
I might see it tomorrow, actually. I think I might see it tomorrow.
I think you should.
Godspeed.
I'd be very interested to hear what you think. And I don't think there's any foregone conclusions to it.
And,
indeed.
Speaking of things that we'd like to hear what Jay thinks about, last week, but didn't make the top 10, is Les Fidèles, or, as it's translated in English, The Racer and the Jailer.
Darren.
I've read some reviews of this. Can't wait to
We saw this at this. Did we? Was it Diff?
It was a Diff.
With Matthew Schoenaerts and I'm not pronounced.
Idealics or Shopless.
That's the one.
Thank you very much.
From Blue Storm's
Cutter. Remember, Darren, our theme for the 250. I am the pronunciation.
You are the pronunciation.
And from the director of Bullhead, which I quite like.
It's good.
But it's not great. It's good. And it's
an interesting take.
Schoenaerts' character in this great and his acting is great. So I was kind of looking forward to this, Darren. I think that would be fair.
I was kind of looking forward to this as well, just based off the premise, which is a race car / bank robber falls in love with a race car driver. And you're like, okay, let's go.
I can go with that, yeah. You got Sean Arts, who's as Darren mentioned, he's this kind of initially he's kind of introduced as he's a businessman, but really they're out robbing the robbing bank stuff. So that's your heat bit, right?
This is like the base.
You said that we need more like new Jack Lemmons.
Yeah,
is it Donica?
Maybe
I think Donica's right.
One of these podcasts, and I'm just sitting here like, where are the new Jack Lemmons? How many new De Niro's am I going to have?
This is like the cupcake base. There's much more to come.
Oh yeah, this like so you get that right. You get what's the pronunciation again?
Schoenaerts.
No, dude. thank you for that. I missed you,
Adele.
There's only two coming. Do you mean Adele Exarchopoulos?
Yeah, she plays a racing car driver for no reason whatsoever.
I think it's a metaphor.
But like she's literally a driving metaphor because it has no relation to the film whatsoever in any way, shape, or form.
She's the racer, then.
Yeah, she is.
Because she's the jailbird,
and she's kind of. You know, they meet at a like kind of a race kind
side
of
function.
Yeah, they can and you know he has to go away, but he has to pull one last job for so he can make it rich.
No.
Oh yeah, there's a last job.
This is only like 30 minutes.
Man, we haven't you haven't even had the start. You just had the order.
This is like you're looking at the menu,
right?
Because it starts out as this weird Michael Mann heat homage, right?
Yeah.
Down to the way that these raids are shot and and time.
It's literally remember the first robbery at the truck, and it's essentially
that, right? And then it takes a really sharp left turn into.
Hang on, let me go.
Okay, we don't want to get ahead of ourselves here.
Right, so you get to that point, right? You get all that. Then you pull up one last job. Needless to say, the last job goes a little awry.
As the English title suggests.
Yes, right?
This is great, just for people who are listening. Jay and Darren are facing me, like they're pitching me this. I am like.
Darren, do you want to take it from there?
Okay,
go on, Darren.
After that job goes sideways, he's sent to prison. She ends up having to wait for him and trying to find a way to keep him alive spiritually while he's in prison. So she hits upon the idea that they
go visit, everything's happy.
It gets better. That they're going to have a child together.
I told you, conjugal visits, everyone's happy.
It gets even better. What happens is the movie transforms into a Lifetime movie directed by Ingmar Bergman.
No.
It features a moment at which she confesses in a letter to him that she is not pregnant with new life.
But pregnant with death.
It's astounding.
It turns into a movie of the week, movie of the week. Like.
She
out of nowhere.
What does that mean?
It might have suffered in the translation a little.
The subtitles are
bad. Shockingly bad.
But so they're going to have a baby, and then she discovers she has cancer.
What?
Yeah. That, it's as gonzo as it sounds. It's all over the shop. It's 2 hours and 10 minutes long. It feels like 4 hours long.
And then
it
sounds like it's a plot. He gets out of prison, and then there's the whole thing of can he get away?
Can he stay out of prison? Yeah.
It is horrendous.
It is every cliche in the book, but none of the cliches that work together.
We were laughing, but not laughing in a this is enjoyable crap, isn't it, Darren? No, we weren't laughing. We're laughing at like how can Phil make it this incompetent?
To be honest, though, I am not pregnant with new life, but with death is my favorite line of the year.
It's an incredible read. Because I suspect the translation might be bad. Good God. You're just coming on every time there's going to be French in movies then.
But yes, you've got two francophones. Bilingual bonus there on the podcast. But yes, sir.
But that's crap. Don't go see it. It's finished in the IFI today, so he
would
Yeah, 1 week. Run and done.
Adieu. What's it like in French again?
La Fidèle.
Adieu à la Fidèle.
It's bad. Like, really, really, really bad.
Glad I skipped over that.
Also, out this week, apparently, is Escape Plan 2, although that's only out in home video media, and it's terrible.
Turkey.
I've seen it. It's absolutely awful. Also,
I listened to the episode of the podcast where you were talking about it, and you took a while in describing it to get to the point where Stallone was in it. I was shocked. It's terrible.
Stallone
is a terrible film. Who thought?
But it's fantastic because Stallone was only available for 3 days, so they have like a new character. But in order to keep Stallone present in the audience's mind, they have a new character sit down and they loop Stallone's dialogue from the first film over it. So it's like, you need 3 things to run a successful jailbreak. The first one is
Moration.
Yeah, it's pretty awful.
It sounds it. And please, people, stop wasting Dave Bautista. He's got more charisma than that.
Speaking of here.
Well, Phil, we may have the movie for you. Also out this week, Hotel Artemis, directed by Drew Pearce, starring Dave Bautista.
Can I just point out, I was walking home from work the other evening, and I walked past a poster of this, and I looked at the cast list. This is pretty, like, this is like an ad-libs of a cast having this film. So beside David Tease, you have, correct me if I'm wrong here, Jodie Foster.
Yeah.
Zachary Quinto.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Day.
Yeah.
I don't even throw any name at this
Sophie Quartella.
Jack
Lemmon. Sterling K. Sterling
Ellis. They
were the
She's
not credited in the trailer, which was the first that I had heard nothing about this and saw the trailer last night.
I was sitting there going,
what is this?
Jodie Foster? To be fair, it's not as if
it convinced me. I was kind of like, you know what? I might go to see this.
I would love to see this. Unfortunately, it's previewing tonight, so I didn't get a chance to see it. Mm-hmm. So just want you guys to know that you mean more to me than seeing that Gonzo cast in action.
That doesn't say.
Kind of words to live by type thing, where the bigger the cast is in the film of names, you know, the direct quality drop down generally it happens, especially when you get to the ands and wits and you still know who they are. It's like, yeah, this is not going to be good.
It does that in the trailer, actually.
Yeah,
you know, the point where you have so many people that you run out of wits and ends. Like, I think the Expendables 3 did with and then with again. This one does also stirring.
Exactly.
Oh, that's bad.
Yeah.
That's
so I'm going to pass on this one.
Do you ever look at, like, a poster or film's credits and think, you got the ant credit?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah.
Imagining that
negotiation. What was the ant credit
of this? Actually, I want to know that now. I always had a Mirren.
I can't remember.
Whether she's
Helen Mirren.
It's Helen Mirren. It's always Helen Mirren.
You have it.
She does.
Dave Bautista gets the Anne credit.
Nice. Ooh,
Charlie,
the world.
Charlie Day gets the with credit.
And who gets
Zachary Quinto gets the also starring credit.
What kind of Gonzo world am I living in?
Well, I mean,
back to front.
To be fair, there is.
Yeah, Jodie
Foster
is
the star.
Jodie Foster is
front
center.
This is really back front. I would go see and Jodie Foster film.
But not.
We did, it was Elysium.
She was second bills.
That was a bad film.
Who was second bills Jodie Foster? Jesus.
To who?
To be fair, like, it's Chris Pratt gets the and in the Infinity War. Josh Brolin gets the wit in there as well.
The least of the Chris's.
Yeah.
There's surely a third conjunction in that kind of film.
No, there's just a long list. I think the biggest surprise is that, like, Gwyneth Paltrow is second. Which is remarkable given
for
that
she's, Infinity War?
Yeah, she's only in
that's
the first
scene. That's kind of like, Liv Tyler had third billing for all three Lord of the Rings movies. I just like to throw that out. That always annoyed me. It annoyed me when I was 13. That still annoyed me.
I like that you never let things go.
I never let this go. I can remember, it was Elijah Wood first. I think it's Viggo Mortensen second.
God, they were innocent times, weren't they?
No, it probably wasn't.
Well, Ian McKellen?
Ian McKellen second, then Liv Tyler.
Wow.
Yep.
She was a bigger name than Mortensen at the time, though, I suppose. Mm.
She could have been Stuart Townsend. What a world we live in.
We were talking about this last night, weren't we?
Yeah. And the alternate world where Dougray Scott is Wolverine and Stuart Townsend is like
Aragorn. God, and Eric Stoltz is Marty McFly.
To be fair,
I think we live in the better world.
I'd like to think that maybe we missed out on something with Stuart Townsend, but I've seen The Extraordinary Gentleman. No, we haven't.
I bet.
Have you not seen what's that one with the one where he plays the staff?
Queen of the Damned.
I saw about 10 minutes of it. I remember I wrote about Battle in Seattle.
Yes.
His one and only directorial debut. I wrote about what's going on because I ended up getting a conversation and somebody reminded me of it. I was like, I must go back and watch that. Written and directed by Stuart Townsend. Like, it's Channing Tatum and everything in it. It's a really odd
kind.
Yeah, it's, well, you know.
Well, presumably.
Yeah, okay. She is it now, she is it.
It would be a bit awkward.
It's not very good, but it's interesting in a lot of ways.
I could take that. Oh, I could go
for it. I could take that too.
Also out this week is Madam, starring Tony Collette and Harvey Keitel, adding a little spice to a waning marriage. Anne and Bob, a wealthy and well-connected American couple, move into a manor house in romantic Paris.
I do not want to see Harvey Keitel doing things.
Romantic.
No, no.
Just that synopsis sounds awful.
Yeah, I think that being released.
Yeah.
No. Is that out?
That's apparently out.
Was Bill Nighy busy?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Alright.
Nice. That's up there. That's up there.
Also out this week, Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. How can you resist?
And the reviews are amazing. The reviews are absolutely amazing.
People are saying it's better than the first one.
And I loved it.
Which is not possible.
Ronan basically bullied me into watching it about 6 weeks ago.
It's the best thing I ever did.
And it was incredible.
Have you never seen it?
Grace.
Grace,
it's on Netflix.
Please.
I think it's on Netflix.
It's very enjoyable.
I know what I'm doing tonight.
I love it's that. Incredible.
It's the best fun.
I say it's their own, right? The first 10-15 minutes, it's a weird kind of like a European TV ad. It looks dubbed. It's that bad. Like, and I was like, and my heart is sinking. It's Amanda Seyfried and whoever the other young people are.
Dominic
Cooper.
And it's awful. And I was like, oh my god, this is terrible. Like, what is Ronan doing to me? 10 minutes later, I was like, this is one of the best films I've ever seen.
Yep.
It is incredible.
It's a sugar rush of a film.
It is.
I do
watch Philip.
I went through
not
this
kidding.
Weird process with Mamma Mia where I watched it years and years and years ago and thought, my God, this is absolutely terrible, but I'm singing ABBA and I'm having a great time. And over, it took me maybe about a year to come around to the fact that, no, it's not terrible. It knows exactly what it's doing, and it does it so, so well.
We should,
like the
it
journey
is.
I went on with Havana Nights, the Dirty Dancing Scene.
Which I have also seen.
This is awful, and then you watch it again, and you're like, it's not.
Yeah,
it kind of is, but it's kind of amazing.
This is exactly what they want to do, and it's working very well. So what's this whole thing about ironically enjoying? No, it's
not ironically enjoying. It's just really good. It's not.
And I've always railed against the idea of the guilty pleasure.
The film is just good.
Where you find it.
Yeah.
We should point out that Jason the Movie Experience has been expanded to include a sing-along version of Mamma Mia 2, Here We Go Again, which may or may not evolve into a field trip.
I wish Darren would stop adding things as all I can say to that.
I will fully go to this.
Yeah,
where
is
that field trip again?
We have to figure out. We have to wait for the screenings to be announced, the sing-along screenings.
The excitement
is palpable.
Also, we'll be seeing that on me very soon. I'll have that watch by next week.
Yeah, absolutely, me too. I'm going this weekend. Twice.
Cannot wait.
Also, this week, A Prayer Before Dawn, starring Joe Cole, the true story of an English boxer incarcerated in one of Thailand's most notorious prisons as he fights in Muay Thai tournaments to earn his freedom.
Can we just
You've gone from my dream to my
we
nightmare.
Can we just move right past this?
Do you know what? I kind of like boxing films. And if there's one like rocks up on Netflix, I'll generally watch it. They're generally the same story over and over.
Mm-hmm.
And it all started with Rocky, and so I generally watched them regardless.
Oui.
But I'm probably going
to
pass on this one.
At this
yeah.
point, to be honest.
The first one is quite extreme. It's
really?
Got a full 18s rating.
Ooh.
And Jay is suddenly back in the game.
18 is strong for like what odds? What audience is it for then, you know?
I don't know.
It's kind of drunk lads on Saturday night.
Yeah,
that's why it's 18.
That's not that many that can
I mean,
go to cinema.
Something if it's going to go the full hog. In fact, it's a violent sport, might as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Remember the days when Van Damme films would come along and
Bloodsport.
I saw them. I saw them all.
Yeah,
I actually rewatched Hard Target. It's great fun.
Hard Target is great fun.
John Woo's best American.
Well,
film.
John Woo, that helps.
Oh, I mean, his best American film is Face Off.
No, it's not.
We're not.
I actually don't like Face Off.
What?
Adam Taylor!
Wait,
oh, thank you.
Face Off.
I used to like it, then I rewatched it a couple of years ago. I was like, this is kind of terrible.
Yes.
It's not even fun.
It's
not.
Cheesy. It's really.
How did you leave?
I think it's barely watchable, but it's just
creepy
so
and weird and
so
nasty.
Nicolas Cage going around and grabbing people's ass.
I think
why is this entertaining?
Yeah, it's Cage and his full-on Cage. Grace,
I'd like to see you. What you think it is?
John Travolta doing full-on Nicolas Cage.
That's I really like the performance aspect of it and what it does with the idea of stardom.
I'm surprised I haven't seen it. It's probably been on TV like 5 times.
Yeah, it's always on.
Over the years, and I still
amazing.
Hard Target, John Travolta punches a snake. That's all you need to know. Go watch it immediately. It's incredible.
Jean-Claude Van Damme is too much fun.
He really is.
What was that film a couple of years back where he showed up and got injured halfway through and just rolled around in a wheelbarrow shouting insults at people?
I can't remember.
I think Jungle was in the title. I can't remember the name.
I don't know
his
name.
Such good
fun. We're
going
to find
out. Like, why have you knocked out Jean-Claude Van Damme?
Have you, was it the Expendables 2 where he played
Jean Valjean?
Jean Valjean.
He did the same thing twice in a row. Kick someone in the face, it's the exact same shot.
And it's amazing.
He executes a guy by roundhouse kicking a dagger through his heart. Jean-Claude Van Damme is amazing.
I love the Expendables too.
Have you read the interview with The Guardian that he did recently promote Jean-Claude Van Damme, it's Jean-Claude Van Johnson.
The show on Amazon.
But he did this wonderful interview where he talks about how they don't talk about it much, but you know that a man's bite is more dangerous than an animal.
That's true.
But it's just in the context.
There's more bacteria in our mouths than there is in a dog's mouth.
But again,
so y'all know,
in the context,
I don't like think about that
too
much.
That's
one of those facts I like throw at people to make.
That's good. I like that one.
Cool.
Kind of like, you know, stars don't exist as we see them. That's how they looked millions of years ago. We don't know if they're still there.
All those are really just stars, echoes of worlds that are.
The sky is the time machine.
Yeah.
Oh god, these are killing me, people.
Alright, and finally out this week is Spitfire, the feature documentary looking at the development and history of the plane.
This sounds incredibly dull.
And timely as well. But yeah, so that's it, guys.
That's the Brexit film.
That is
another one.
Yeah.
You idiot. Anyway, sorry.
Thus concludes the Scannon Political Hour.
Join me next week. We have Nigel Farage as a guest. No, we will not.
But yeah, I like the idea that Jake couldn't get Marisa Tomei, but Nigel Farage is a shoo-in.
That'd be just my luck.
That would be. All right, so anyway, if listeners want a bit more of Phil, Grace, Jay, or Ronan in their lives, where can they find you guys?
I don't know.
In a bunker.
Shying away from the world.
Well, generally, yeah, this is my first appearance in these so far. You might see me again in another 6 months. Who knows?
Woohoo!
Although I do appear on the 250 on occasion.
You can be like that guest character that whenever they appear, the audience claps.
The next door neighbor.
And just awkwardly stands there waiting to say their name.
Just pops my head in the door.
Great. You need a catchphrase.
You do.
Yeah, you do.
You need a catchphrase. You're all fucking appalled.
Okay,
that's... work.
He said it. He said it.
He said the line.
I am on Twitter at Pixie Grace.
At Jay Coyle.
At Baron Ron.
At Darren _ Mini, also co-host the podcast The 250, where this week we'll be covering The Incredibles 2, so you can hear us talking in great depth about how much we love the film, and also how much we hate it for a solid hour. Take it easy, guys. We'll be back next week. Bye.
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 Who hated it?
No, it's an interesting one because we loved it,
so
but the only thing that we can talk about on it is...
The fact that it's not The Incredibles.
Yeah. Which one of these is the stop button?
Oh, God, this stays in.